We'll talk with a psychiatrist this hour who says the mental health system in this country is broken and we're all worse off because of it. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest is the author of American Psychosis, How the Federal Government Destroyed the Mental Health Treatment System. And he'll tell us how we can try to fix it. And if you have any questions, thoughts, or experiences with the mental health system, maybe a loved one who can't get the help he or she needs, we welcome them for our guest at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Dr. E. Fuller Torrey. He is a psychiatrist, a schizophrenia researcher, the founder of the Treatment Advocacy Center. He was also on staff at the National Institutes of Mental Health when the federal mental health program was being developed after President Kennedy proposed a new program where the federal government would fund community mental health centers to take the place of state mental hospitals. This was in response to what President Kennedy called the shabby treatment of the many millions of the mentally disabled who are in custodial institutions. It was later called deinstitutionalization. Dr. Torrey is the author of many books, most recently American Psychosis, How the Federal Government Destroyed the Mental Health Treatment System. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Torrey.
It's my pleasure, Joy.
Tell us about President Kennedy's address before Congress 50 years ago. What was he calling for?
His address before Congress, and I might add that he was interested in this because his sister had been initially mentally retarded and then became mentally ill. And so they did a lobotomy on her, which was a disaster, and she then spent the rest of her life in a convent in Wisconsin. So he was when he took office, he was very interested in doing something to help the mentally ill and the mentally retarded. And out of that came the idea to use federal funds to fund community mental health centers across the states. And it's important to realize that before that, this had never been a federal responsibility. This had always been a state responsibility. And in fact, Wisconsin was one of the states that was doing better than a lot of states at that time.
Well, so he just thought that somehow people wouldn't have lobotomies if they were in federally funded community health centers?
Well, he had the idea, and it wasn't his idea, it was the people who were working under him, that somehow the federal government could do this better than the state governments had done it. You know, up until the late 1950s, we had no treatments. People were in the state hospitals. There were huge state hospitals in all the states, including Wisconsin. And so we didn't have much to offer them. But then we got medication, and just as we were getting medication and had something to offer them, that's when the Kennedy administration decided that somehow this should be a federal responsibility and not a state responsibility. It had been a state responsibility for about 150 years. So this was a major shift from the states to the federal government.
Yeah, I thought that President Reagan had a lot to do with deinstitutionalization.
Well, actually, all five presidents who were Democrat and all five presidents who were Republican have had a lot to do with it. Reagan is often blamed for it, but in fact, when Reagan took office in California, the state hospitals had been deinstitutionalized by about half. What Reagan really was targeted with was during his administration, he tried to decrease the number of people who were on disability, and he is therefore blamed by a lot of people for being the person who was responsible for deinstitutionalization, which is not true. As I mentioned, all five presidents who were Democrats and all five who were Republicans since the 1960s share equal responsibility. This is not a political problem. This is an equal opportunity political disaster.
Well, why were the state-run hospitals better than federally funded community mental health facilities?
Well, the state hospitals were not. And in fact, the idea of emptying out the state hospitals to a certain degree was a very good idea. So deinstitutionalization itself was not a bad idea. We had medications to treat people in the community. What we did was we emptied the hospitals without providing the treatment for the people once they were in the community. Now, about half the people recognize that they're sick and will seek treatment, but about half the people with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder have damage to the part of the brain that we use to think about ourselves, so they don't think they're sick. They actually think the CIA is sending the messages to them, etc., and most of them will not voluntarily seek treatment. And that's where you get into the issue of, can we treat people in the community, keep them on medication without having to put them back in the hospital? But we haven't done that very well at all, and that's the source of the disaster.
Yeah, so the pendulum swung too far in the other direction.
Yeah, it's swung too far in that we didn't realize that people, and these were not mean people, these were people who thought they were doing the right thing, didn't realize that about half the people who were being emptied out of the hospital would not, and in fact could not, voluntarily seek treatment because they didn't realize they were sick.
And it is too hard to commit somebody.
It is almost impossible to commit people in many states. In fact, the Wisconsin plays a major role in that. The 1972 decision, the Lessard decision in Wisconsin, was one of the most influential decisions, making it extremely difficult to get people in the hospital. It ruled that you had to be immediately dangerous and that you had to have recent overt acts of dangerousness, and that influenced a lot of other states. So the Lessard decision in Wisconsin was one of the most important reasons why we're in trouble today.
I didn't realize that that started in Wisconsin.
Yep.
But we're concerned about the civil liberties of everybody.
Of course we are, and I think that we recognize that people who have heart disease or people who have diabetes are able to think about whether they need treatment or not. What we don't realize is that many of the people with severe mental illnesses like schizophrenia are unable to recognize the fact that they're sick. So either you have to say, yes, we'll protect everyone's civil liberties and people have the right to be as psychotic as they want on the streets or in the jails and the prisons, or we're going to make sure these people get treatment so that they don't commit acts of violence, so that they don't end up homeless on the streets, so that they don't end up wandering around downtown Milwaukee or Madison and causing problems.
Yeah, give us some idea of the scope of the problem of untreated severe mental illness.
Well, we have about 2.6 million people with schizophrenia, adults with schizophrenia in the United States today. About half of those, about 1.3 million, are not being treated at any given time. So when you go to the Madison Public Library, where I was in a couple of years ago, you see many of these people who are not being treated using the public library as a day hospital, basically. I've been in Milwaukee a few years ago, and in fact, Meg Kissinger's has documented in the Milwaukee Journal the terrible problems of the untreated mentally ill in Milwaukee on it. This is not a Wisconsin problem. This is a national problem, but it's seen in every state, and it's seen now in every major city.
Yeah, so why can't, what was it about President Kennedy's vision of community-centered treatment that didn't work? Or tell us about that. You know, is it just because the mentally ill, severely mentally ill, don't know when they need help?
That's the main thing, and that was not recognized. So they set up the community mental health centers. They ultimately funded over 700 of them. But the community mental health centers were only interested in seeing people who came there voluntarily. They didn't treat the people who were coming out of the state hospitals. In fact, less than 5% of the people that were treated in the community mental health centers had any severe mental illness on it. So what we were doing is two things at the same time. One is we were emptying out the hospitals, and at the same time we were federally funding community mental health centers that were not taking care of the people coming out of the hospitals.
And you say now, too, a lot of the resources in our mental health system are going to those who are maybe mildly mentally depression, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, psychiatrists, psychologists, psychiatric social workers, it's much easier to take care of people who voluntarily seek treatment, who have milder problems, problems of living or mild depression or anxiety or why their teenage daughter won't speak to them. That's much easier and much more rewarding, in fact. Taking care of people with severe mental illnesses is difficult. It's much more difficult than taking care of the easy patients. And by and large, psychiatry has, with a few exceptions, has stayed away from treating the most severely mentally ill, and that's a major part of the problem.
So What are the solutions to this broken mental illness treatment system?
Well, for one thing, in my book, American Psychosis, I argue that we have had a 50-year federal experiment, started in 1963, and in fact, ironically, yet tomorrow, which is October 31st, is exactly the 50th anniversary of the signing by President Kennedy of the Community Mental Health Centers Act. So we've had a 50-year experiment, and I would argue that it's been a failed experiment, that the outcome has been mentally ill people in jails and prisons, homeless, episodes of violence, etc. I think it's time to give the responsibility back to the states and give the money back to the states, Medicaid, SSI, SSDI, and then hold the states responsible so that in Wisconsin, Governor Walker is the person who would be ultimately responsible. The state legislature would be ultimately responsible if the system fails.
Well, how do you do that, though? What if our governor and legislature say, well, we'll just keep things the way they are?
Oh, of course that's what they want. Anytime you can get the feds to do the work, the governors are quite happy to give it to them, and especially this kind of a job, which is not an easy job. But you could, by federal legislation, put the money and the responsibility back at the state level. There are some states that probably would be glad to take the responsibility because the situation has gotten so bad, and because citizens generally across the United States now are recognizing that whatever we're doing is not working, both in terms of the number of mentally ill people we see on the streets, the number of mentally ill in jails and prisons, and especially the episodes of violence committed by people with severe mental illness that are not being treated. And, of course, we've seen a lot of these in an increasing number in recent years.
Well, including a lot of the recent mass shootings.
About 50% of the mass shootings are caused by people with severe mental illness who are not being treated. Jared Loughner in Tucson, James Holmes in Aurora, certainly Aaron Alexis, the recent one, the fellow who shot up the Washington Navy Yard and killed 12 people there. These are people who should have been in treatment. And if we had a rational system, they would have been in treatment. But we don't have a rational system.
Yeah, how do we have this rational system that, you know, I guess balances the civil rights of the mentally ill with the safety of the community?
We can do that, Joy. We have over a million lawyers in this country. We're not short of lawyers. Nobody, including myself, psychiatrist, should have the right to unilaterally put someone in a hospital without any judicial review on it. In states where we have the assisted outpatient treatment, where it is used, for example, the person has the right to be defended. They have the right to appeal to the judge. You can set up a system where you are protecting people's rights. But at this point, the way the laws are written in most states, it is very, very difficult to treat someone involuntarily until they have committed a crime. And a crime like Jared Loughner, for example, who should have been treated. And there was clearly debate about whether to refer him for treatment. And the decision was, no, it's too difficult to get him in treatment.
We had a very sad case within the last year here in Wisconsin where a mentally ill man ended up killing a family he didn't even know. Obviously, his parents had tried to find help for him, tried to get him committed, tried to stop him. They warned authorities that he was delusional and potentially dangerous, but the county mental health professionals, I guess, didn't think he was an imminent threat.
That is a problem, and it's a problem everywhere. In Wisconsin, it's a particular problem because Mendota, for example, the major mental hospital outside Madison, will only take people who are court-ordered to the you cannot voluntarily go in Mendota now unless you're court-ordered there. So for someone who's trying to get help, we have closed down so many beds that there's no beds left for people like that to treat them for 2 weeks or 3 weeks and stabilize them on medication. And so for families that are looking for help, this is a huge problem.
We are talking with Dr. Torrey. He is a psychiatrist. He is a schizophrenia researcher. He is the author of many books, including most recently, American Psychosis, How the Federal Government Destroyed the Mental Illness Treatment System. And we're talking about current problems in the system. and some possible solutions. And we're welcoming your questions, your own experiences, perhaps. Has a friend or loved one ever received treatment for mental illness? Did you run into some of these issues? 1-800-642-1234. What changes would you make to the mental health system if you could? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking with Dr. Fuller Torrey. He is the author of a new book, American Psychosis, How the Federal Government Destroyed the Mental Illness Treatment System. And we are welcoming your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Dr. Torrey talks about how 50 years ago, President John F. Kennedy addressed Congress on mental illness and mental retardation, and he proposed a new program at that time where the federal government would fund community mental health centers to take the place of state mental hospitals. Kennedy described the shabby treatment of the many millions of mentally disabled in custodial institutions, and it was believed to be all a tribute to his sister Rosemary, who had developed a schizophrenia-like illness and was eventually lobotomized. Our guest says that the good intentions of President Kennedy's initiative have gone awry, and today one-third of the homeless are seriously mentally ill, as are 20% of those in prison, and there are many more mentally ill people not getting the treatment that they need. So we are talking about the past, present, and what needs to be done to fix our mental health system for the future. We have many calls, Dr. Torrey, but you're talking a lot about coming to Wisconsin. I'm just curious as to, were you here in research of this book since Rosemary Kennedy spent her final years in Wisconsin?
I was there actually for researching a previous book when I included the Brian Stanley case, the fellow who had shot the priest in Onalaska. And so I became quite familiar with what was going on in Wisconsin. And Wisconsin has always been of interest because it was really one of the leaders in leading the program for treatment in the community called the PAC program, which came out of the Mendota State Hospital and the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And so it has a national mm-hmm. reputation for attempting to do things, but at this point it's gone. And at one time, 20 years ago, Wisconsin was ranked among the top probably 5 or 7 states in terms of the job they were doing for treating people with severe mental illnesses. But that's 20 years ago. It's really gone downhill terribly since, as almost all the states have.
Yeah. Briefly, why is it that you, everybody believes that President Kennedy was so focused on this mental health initiative because of his sister Rosemary?
Well, Kennedy never talked about his sister. In fact, it's not quite clear that he ever visited his sister once she became disabled on it. But it is within the family. It was one of the biggest disasters. Mrs. Kennedy, for example, at one time said that losing her sons, as she lost 3 sons, was terrible. But losing her daughter, Rosemary, was even worse. So it was a major source of trauma, which the Kennedys didn't talk about, because the Kennedys don't talk about those things, even to this day. And in fact, when I tried to get access to the Kennedy libraries and records, they denied it twice. And I think most of the records probably have been destroyed anyway on this. But if you put all the pieces together, it's very clear that Rosemary's lobotomy was a disaster and from which the family never completely recovered.
Yeah. Why did they choose Wisconsin? Was it Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin, or Jefferson, Wisconsin?
Yes, that's where it was, just north of Fort Atkinson in Jefferson, I think. That's because there was a Catholic convent there that was recommended by the Archbishop in Boston, and they wanted to get her away from where the media would be likely to track her down. Originally, they were going to place her outside Boston. They thought that was just too close to people from the media who might have access. And to this day, nobody has ever publicly acknowledged from the family exactly what happened, but it's very clear what happened.
Yeah. Well, what stops a state-run mental health hospital from performing lobotomies on people who are mentally ill and can't stop them?
Well, legally today, that would be very, very difficult to do, and lobotomies are fortunately not used anymore, except very rarely for cases of epilepsy that cannot be controlled in any other way. But in that case, brain surgery sometimes is the only option on it. But certainly brain surgery is not used for people with severe mental illnesses today, because we have, for the first time, we have really 15 or 20 different kinds of medication that work in, 3/4, 80% of the cases quite well, so that most people who have severe mental illnesses are able to live in the community, and if they stay on their medication, able to live, in many cases, reasonably normal lives. But if you don't think you're sick, if you really think the CIA is sending messages into your brain, there's no reason to take medication. All you want to do is get back at the CIA, or as in the recent woman who came to the White House, get back at the White House for what she felt that President Obama was doing to her. These people really believe these things. This is what they're experiencing in their brain, and it's important to understand that they have no awareness of their illness at all. They think these things are real.
We have many callers, so let's go to Ann in Michigan first. Hello, Ann.
Hi. I was seeing a psychologist for severe chronic depression, and she came to the conclusion that it was medication that I needed help with, and in order to do that, I would have to see a psychiatrist, of course. And so she tried to get me into the community mental health for 2.5 years. For 2.5 years, they told me that they couldn't see me because I was on disability, and disability means you have Medicare coverage. And they said they could only see people who had no coverage at all. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up is because this kind of, like, administrative glitch is really typical of this kind of situation. I don't know if it's lack of staff or lack of competency. I don't know what it is, but this is not unusual in this situation here. In the end, it was corrected by someone who said, oh, yeah, that was just a mistake.
Wow, 2.5 years to see a psychiatrist because she had Medicaid coverage, Dr. Torrey.
Most of the states have cut down, cut out a lot of the funds for treating people with severe mental illnesses, so it's not unusual. Many of the community mental health centers that exist are overwhelmed with patients on it. And again, what you have is you have certain rules that come out of Washington, coverage by Medicaid, Medicare, in terms of what you can do with the federal funds that are dictated by Washington, that ties the hands of people in the states and at the local level. And that's one reason why I think if the responsibility was put back at the state and local level, that you'd have a more rational system. So 2.5 years, I've heard that. That's a long, long time, especially when severe depression is usually quite treatable.
Yeah. And severe depression is actually quite serious, too. A lot of people think, well, you're just depressed. I mean, that a severe depression can even be psychotic, can it not?
Severe depression is very disabling. Some people can't leave home. Some people can't even get out of bed. And, of course, that's the source of many suicides. So that, yes, it needs to be treated, and it needs to be treated usually very, very soon, certainly not waiting 2.5 years.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, I also know someone that was trying to get in to see a psychiatrist who had mental health issues, who would not, however, go to an emergency room or a hospital to admit that he was thinking of taking his own life or going into a psychotic episode. And it still was going to, okay, well, we can see him in a couple of weeks. I mean, is there a shortage of psychiatrists or what?
Yes, there's a shortage of psychiatrists, especially in the public sector. Mm-hmm. Most of the psychiatrists are in the private sector, and most of them would prefer to see less ill patients if they can do so. Emergency rooms are used by the severely mentally ill very widely. In fact, many of the emergency rooms now are being kind of overwhelmed by the mentally ill people who are trying to get a bed in the hospital, and where there's no beds in the hospital. So these people end up staying in the emergency room for sometimes days at a time while they're waiting for a bed. This is a major problem in emergency rooms now all over the country.
Ben in Two Rivers is with us. Hello, Ben.
Good morning.
Yes, go ahead, Ben.
I just wanted to bring up the observation that it's not just involuntarily committing people who need help that's a problem. I had an aunt who in the 80s was diagnosed with bipolar, got it under control of medication, but when her medication would be out of whack, she'd try and get help, and she'd get turned away everywhere. And in the end, she would find a cop and either verbally or physically assault the cop and get arrested, and that's how she would finally get treatment.
Well, that's kind of sad.
Ben, what you're describing is actually very common. There are actually many places in the United States now where, unless you're arrested, it's almost impossible to get treatment. And being purposely arrested is something I've heard of quite frequently. In fact, I've even heard a public official saying to families, you know, the only way you're going to get help for your son or your daughter is if she is arrested and gets into the jail or the prison system on it. I mean, that's a pathetic commentary on the system that we have, which is broken, and that's really why I wrote the book American Psychosis, is to describe how it got broken, because if we don't understand how it got broken, it's going to be hard to fix. So what you're describing is not all that unusual, and in fact, go to any of your major police departments or sheriffs in Wisconsin, they can describe the same thing.
Yeah. What helps, Dr. Torrey, though, when someone who has a severe mental illness but is taking the proper medication decides that now they feel better and everything's okay and they stop taking their medication?
Well, in some cases, stopping the medication may be perfectly appropriate. For example, when a depression clears, you don't take antidepressants indefinitely in most cases on it. Even in the cases of schizophrenia, after you've had one or two episodes, it is generally accepted now to treat for a period of a few weeks and then to cut it down to see whether you still need medication. Some people do need to take medication for their entire lives, but many people do not. And that's why you need a skilled psychiatrist, and it should be a psychiatrist or an internist, a physician of some kind who is trained to use these medications and to work with them. But we have relatively few of these people. And because the reimbursement under Medicaid, they'd rather do private practice than practice in a public setting where their reimbursement rate is much lower.
Are you calling for an increase in those reimbursement rates?
Absolutely. You need an increase in the reimbursement rates. But again, what you have, Joy, is you have people in Washington making these decisions who really don't understand what's going on in Wisconsin or Montana or California. There's very different situations in many of the states. And this is why I think Washington does many things well. I've lived here for 30 years. I think we do research pretty well under NIH. I think we have a Defense Department that does wars in most cases pretty good. But we don't do human services well at all. I think human services belong at the state or in large states at the county level. And that's one of the major problems, is the belief that we can do these things out of Washington, when in fact I think that has shown not to work out.
Let's take another call from Hans in New Berlin. Hello.
Hello. I want to ask, have things changed that much the last several decades? Because I've been involved with committing two different people who had, one had severe schizophrenia and a psychotic break, and the other had severe dementia. And not that it was pleasant, but it seemed like the process worked for us. And these happened, one was several decades ago and one was about a decade ago. Has it changed that much recently? Because for us, it seemed to have worked.
It has changed, Hans, and it's gotten progressively worse. I've been in this business since the late 1960s, and I can tell you that getting help for someone in the 1970s or 80s was much easier than it is now. As we have progressively cut down the funds and emptied out the hospitals, it's gotten more and more difficult to get help for the families. Most of the families out there are really stymied when they try and get help for their family member now. even compared to 10 years ago.
So, Dr. Torrey, what needs to happen to employ the fixes that you're proposing?
Well, first, I think we've got to get enough beds. We've cut down the beds so that there are virtually no public beds left for people who are severely mentally ill who need to be hospitalized, often for short periods of time on it. Secondly, we need to recognize that there are a group of people who have damage to their brain, mostly with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, so they don't recognize, they don't realize that they're sick. And unless we are able to understand that and realize that some people need to be treated involuntarily in what we call assisted outpatient treatment, which basically says, yes, you can live in the community as long as you take your medicine, but we know if you don't take your medicine, you get in trouble, you become violent, you cause problems, you commit crimes, et cetera, et cetera. That's what we call assisted outpatient treatment. Wisconsin has such a law, but it's not used very much on it. Thirdly, I think we have to have somebody who's responsible. At this point, Joy, nobody's responsible. Governor Walker's not responsible. President Obama's not responsible. Nobody's responsible because you've got a system of funding the mental health services from 100 different sources, some federal, some state, even some county on it. And whereas before 1963, you could hold the state responsible, you could hold the state legislature responsible and the governor, you can't hold anybody responsible now. That's why I think you need to remove the responsibility back at the state level and then hold them responsible so that there is somebody to blame, so that when you have an election for governor, for example, this is one of the issues that should be discussed.
Our guest is Dr. Fuller Torrey. He is a psychiatrist, and he is the author of many books, most recently American Psychosis, How the Federal Government Destroyed the Mental Illness Treatment System. We're talking about what went wrong, how things are now, and what might fix things for the future. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking with the author of American Psychosis, How the Federal Government Destroyed the Mental Health Treatment System, Dr. Fuller Torrey. And if you have any questions, thoughts, or experiences with the mental health system, we welcome them at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dan in Schulzburg is with us now. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hello. First of all, I do have a friend of mine that suffers from schizophrenia, and that's created a lot of issues. I must admit, when I first really became friends with him, he didn't really have any severe symptoms. And we'd often joke about how a social worker would come see him and ask him, questions like ask him what day it is and things. And we kind of joked about how silly that was until actually one day I came to see him and he had stopped taking his meds and he literally didn't know what day it was or where he was and a lot of things. So, I mean, plus at some point he did end up in the Mendota mental health facility, which I felt bad that he was sent there, but I was actually a little bit relieved because I knew, first of all, he was somewhere where he's safe. He couldn't hurt himself or others. And he was actually able to get some proper treatment, which he obviously wasn't getting outside. Second of all, I've gone to school for law enforcement. I've done a lot of training. Unfortunately, I haven't put on the badge and uniform yet, but I'm still working on that. But I've taken some classes in dealing specifically with mentally ill who are, well, usually a threat to themselves or others, and determining that and properly handling that. And we've discussed a great deal about, well, I guess the would have been the deinstitutionalization process of 1970s and 80s. And I've worked with like police officers or gone to school with them who've had a lot of issues with that, because now instead of all these people being treated in a mental health facility, they're all on the streets, and you know, the it's up to law enforcement to deal with them, and they don't have the resources or proper training, and it's unfortunate because one, it's overwhelming for their situation it's overwhelming, or they're exhausting a lot of resources on them, and plus it's not really fair to the individuals because now they're getting treated like common criminals when it's not really always their fault.
Right, and a lot of times they're incarcerated in jail or in prison, Dr. Torrey, and not getting any treatment for their mental illness.
Yes, I'd say, first of all, Dan, you're being a good friend to your friend with schizophrenia, and that's very, very important because people with schizophrenia need friends like all of us need friends on it. Secondly, I'm impressed that the social worker was visiting. That's exactly the way the system's supposed to work, so that there is follow-up to see whether the person is doing okay in the community. And in this case, it seems to have worked that when he had stopped taking his medication and then relapsed with his symptoms, which happens very often, he did get help on it. In terms of the correctional system, you're absolutely right. The correctional system now is the frontline workers and the frontline. They've replaced the mental hospitals, basically. In Wisconsin, I'm involved right now in a study state by state looking at the number of mentally ill people in jails and prisons. And in Wisconsin, the largest mental institution in terms of number of severely mentally ill people in the institution is the Milwaukee County Jail, followed by the prisons in Oshkosh and Racine. Mm-hmm. All three of those have more mentally ill people than does Mendota or Winnebago. So that the correctional system has kind of replaced the state hospital system. And this is kind of crazy because people who go into corrections like yourself go into corrections to take care of people who are criminals. If you wanted to be a mental health worker, you'd become a mental health worker. So many of the people who are working in the jails and prisons now have de facto become mental health workers because that increasing number of the people in the jails and prisons, about 20%, are severely mentally ill.
Yeah, I guess I said they're not getting any treatment. Do they get any treatment at all if it's determined they're mentally ill, or aren't they determined to be mentally ill?
That's exactly the question that we're asking, Joy, mm-hmm. because there's no good data on that. We're looking state by state. These are state laws. It depends on the state. State laws usually cover the prisons, and depending on the state law, you can treat people involuntarily under certain circumstances, but often it's very difficult. Jail is another matter. In most states, it's difficult to treat people involuntarily in jail, so they end up in seclusion. They end up being victimized by other prisoners. They end up causing chaotic problems in jails, and it's a terrible problem.
Yeah. Is there, Dr. Torrey, anything that's done? Let's say somebody is hospitalized involuntarily, as rare as that might be, is there some sort of transition that occurs instead of just, saying, all right, yeah, we're done with you now, go live your life?
What you're talking about is logic and what should happen. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen in most cases. If the person has been in jail or prison and serves out their term, they're basically released. And in most states, there's no transition to the mental health system. And again, that has to do with who's responsible and who's supposed to be following these people. So it's totally a broken system. Mm-hmm. And you're talking logic. You're talking about what should happen. It's not happening in Wisconsin. It's not happening in any other state.
Let's take another call from Joy in West Bend now. Hello, Joy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to talk more about the so-called mental health parity. There's been a couple of times when there's been news stories that, oh, yes, now we have mental health parity and treatment for mental health issues should be paid for in the same way that physical health ailments are paid, and it's really hasn't been true. We, for instance, my husband and I wanted to have some couples counseling, learn how to communicate better with each other as a preventative measure to make sure our lives don't fall apart. And we had good coverage through a union health insurance, but we'd have to go through a gatekeeper to get treatment, and we kind of actually had to make up symptoms to be able to get coverage for a few visits. And I know that there is a requirement for group plans in Wisconsin to have mental health coverage, but anybody who has an individual plan doesn't have to have mental health coverage, and that leaves people completely in the, you know, up a creek, you know, when they're trying to get some help, even when they're aware of their need and trying to get some help. It's just quite expensive to try to get a psychiatrist appointment or counseling appointments.
Right. So, so is that going to change under the Affordable Care Act? Do you know, Dr. Torrey?
Yeah, that's in theory that it depends on your insurance coverage as to whether it'll cover something like marriage counseling on it. You don't need a psychiatrist for marriage counseling. Psychologists and psychiatric social workers do quite nicely in most cases on it. But don't underestimate the ability of the insurance companies to not pay for what they're supposed to pay for. That's why they have big profits, and they're very skilled at figuring out loopholes that they can avoid covering things.
Yeah, and is it your belief, Dr. Torrey, that covering minor mental health issues is, a little easier than caring for the severely mentally ill?
Well, it is easier. I would argue that the first money off the top ought to go for the most severely ill people. If there's enough money left over, then I think covering things like marriage counseling is fine. But unfortunately, we've done better at covering things like marriage counseling than we have at covering the people with the most severe problems.
Amanda, in an email, says, your guest said that involuntary treatment occurs when we know someone gets violent or commits crimes when they're off their meds. What's far more likely to happen is that they become dangerous to themselves or stop caring for themselves. People with mental illness are stigmatized as being criminals, and that's just not the case.
Well, she's absolutely right. Danger to self is much greater than danger to others on it, and suicide is not at all uncommon among people who have severe mental illnesses and are not being treated on it. In terms of stigma, I think that it's important to realize where the sources of stigma come from. The major source of stigma in the association of people with severe mental illnesses as being violent comes from these horrific episodes of mass killings, of which half of them are responsible or are due to people with severe mental illness not being treated. If we were stopping these kinds of mass killings, stigma would go down markedly on it. But as long as we are not willing to treat people involuntarily, like Jared Loughner, who needed to be treated involuntarily, and instead saying, yes, we're going to defend his civil rights and treat him only after he's killed 12 people, then we're going to have the problem of stigma forever.
Another email from, or no, this is Todd on Facebook, who says, I'm confused. Is this an access issue or an issue of public safety and appropriate facilities other than public libraries and prisons? I don't think it's okay to start pointing at people in the street and start walking them into a facility that they don't want to go into. I think the guest needs to know that unintended consequences are that people will be forced to do things that are against their civil liberties.
Well, I think that Todd may be willing to leave severely mentally ill people on the streets who don't know that they're sick. And I think that you can defend that on a civil libertarian point of view on it. I don't agree with that. I volunteered with a homeless mentally ill for 16 years, and I saw the consequences of people who were severely mentally ill, especially women living on the street who were victimized on a regular basis. And I will also say that if I develop severe schizophrenia next week and don't know that I'm sick, I hope somebody will involuntarily hospitalize me and treat me. But again, this is a civil liberties issue, and there are people who say, no, you should never treat people involuntarily. They have a right to be psychotic. They have a right to live on the street. But what you're looking at is the consequences of that, and I think the consequences are not very appealing.
Evelyn is with us in Wisconsin. Hi, Evelyn.
Hello. I'm calling because this is such a relevant program. My granddaughter, 24 years of age, had mental illness problems, and she was using alcohol and some medications, you know, prescribed medications. She was able to double up with two different doctors, one in Wisconsin, one in Minnesota. She fell through, when I left her, I had to remove her car, my car, from her because I was afraid of ethical, you know, issues. I left her in treatment in Minnesota, and they really liked her, and I had such hope. Instead, she was released from treatment early because she had done a good job. They were trying to find a safe home for her to live in. She had to live with four guys until then. It never came through. She became more angry. She finally became violent. When she gave up, because there was no housing forthcoming, she took her life on January the 16th, 2013. And she left a note. And because she didn't have a car, she couldn't get to her, you know, outpatient meetings as easily. And she couldn't keep her job. She couldn't get to her job easily enough. And on the 16th of January, she took an overdose of citralopram, which is Celexa, and she died within 3 to 5 hours. And I wish that the treatment people would have kept her in longer. She wrote me a hopeful letter in October, and then she was deceased in January. And I know that we're always short on time, so that's all I'll say right now.
Yeah, I'm sorry,
Evelyn,
for your
I'm
loss,
sorry
Evelyn.
About your granddaughter. I'd like to tell you this is a rare occurrence, but it's not. About 10% of the people with severe mental illness take their own lives. In this case, probably was preventable if there'd been an adequate treatment system for her on it. As the treatment system, as we've emptied the hospitals and closed down the treatment system, there's very little out there to offer for people like your granddaughter, and some of them do just give up. I think that this is a symptom of the severe breakdown in the whole system that should lead us to go back and say we need to start at square one and figure out how to put this back in line.
Well, Vice President Joe Biden recently said that the country was on the cusp of mental health reform. Are you optimistic that some of these reforms will line up with your suggestions?
I admire Vice President Biden, but I don't know where he was coming from on that because I haven't seen any sign of it turning around. What I have seen, Joy, is I've seen, especially in the last 5 years, an increasing awareness that the system's broken. And that's the first step toward figuring out how to fix it. But President Biden, Vice President Biden, for example, ran a committee to figure out after the Sandy Hook disaster what should be done. Very little came out of that. I don't think President Obama or Vice President Biden really understand the problem any more than the past presidents or vice presidents have. We really had no good federal leadership on this. And, in fact, the federal agency that's responsible for this, called the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, is one of the least functional agencies in Washington.
In our final minute, somebody listening right now wants to try to advocate for change. What can an individual do?
Several things. Number one, you can go on the website of the Treatment Advocacy Center, which I started 15 years ago. It's www.treatmentadvocacycenter.org on it. Secondly, you can get in touch with your local NAMI group. At the local level, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, as it's called, NAMI, has very good education programs on learning about severe mental illness and what you can do. And third, you become an advocate just by, from your own experience or the experience of people who are mentally ill. This is something you should be taking to your state legislators, and you also should be taking it to your national representatives.
Thank you very much, Dr. Fuller-Torrey. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.